Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
The podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. I hope you're well. Plenty coming up on the programme. What can Thailand's new Prime Minister do to help her country out of its economic malaise? And we're in Kashmir as it prepares for the opening of the world's highest single arch railway bridge. But we're going to start in the world's largest economy, the United States, because Kamala Harris has been outlining her economic program ahead of those US presidential elections, which, of course, are in November. She was speaking at a campaign rally in Raleigh in North Carolina.
As president, I will be laser focused on creating opportunities for the middle class that advance their economic security, stability, and dignity. Together, we will build what I call an opportunity economy.
She gave more details on what the so-called opportunity economy would mean for Americans, and in particular, the middle class.
We must defend basic principles, such as your salary should be enough to provide you and your family with a good quality of life. No child should have to grow up in poverty, such as after years of hard work, you should be able to retire with dignity. And you should be able to join a union if you choose. Building up the middle class will be a defining goal of my presidency.
The Democratic presidential nominee also addressed one of the key issues of the campaign, inflation, and in particular, rising food prices.
A loaf of bread cost 50% more today than it did before the pandemic. Ground beef is up almost 50%. Many of the big food companies are seeing their highest profits in two decades. Look, I know most businesses are creating jobs, contributing to our economy, and playing by the rules. But some are not. And that's just not right. And we need to take action when that is the case.
Let's get some more analysis of this speech from Niall Stanage, White House correspondent for The Hill, the Washington, D.C.-based political publication. Niall, thanks so much for joining us again on World Business Report. This is an important speech, isn't it? Because Kamala Harris is doing well in the polls, but one area where she seems to be lagging behind Donald Trump is on the economy, and in particular issues like inflation.
Well, that's right. And the reason for that is because President Biden is not popular on those issues. And obviously, Vice President Harris is tethered to him for entirely clear reasons. And then that is a problem. So she lags Trump on the economy. And as we know, particularly in relative peacetime, the economy is often the central issue in American elections. So yes, this was a vital speech trying to sort of reframe the whole election campaign as one in which Harris sees herself as fighting for ordinary people, for want of a better phrase, and is trying to paint Trump as in the pockets of the rich.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? She made a lot of references to the middle class in her speech, particularly when she talked about this opportunity economy. Was that surprising to focus so much on the middle class?
Well, I don't know that it was all that surprising. For a start, we should say the term middle class is used in a very different way in the United States to how it's used in the United Kingdom. So here it is used in the US, it is used to mean sort of everyone from people on very modest incomes to quite affluent. The phrase working class is not used here nearly so much. So she's trying to position herself as a champion of everyday Americans.
I want to bring in Chris Lowe here as well, who is chief economist at FHN Financial. Chris, always a pleasure having you on the program. We heard her there talking about supermarkets. Price gouging is the phrase that's used in the US, isn't it? This idea that it's supermarkets taking off too much profits, which drove up prices. Is that correct, though? Because there are many who say it was the stimulus from President Biden that was also a factor.
Well, it was a combination of many things. There were all kinds of production and transportation issues during the pandemic, some of which have been resolved, others have not. There's clearly also huge amounts of stimulus still coming into the economy. Whether price controls are the best solution to that, I'm skeptical. They tend to create shortages, at least they have when used in the U.S. in the past.
Niall, you talked earlier about the fact that Donald Trump, particularly on the issue of inflation, may be doing better than Vice President Harris. Is one of her problems going to be to try and distance herself from President Biden because he is so closely associated with inflation? And of course, she's part of that particular group of people who are in office.
Yes, I think that is going to be a problem. We're already seeing just today the Trump campaign and associated entities pushing back on that exact basis, saying that, for example, in one instance, the stench of Bidenomics can't be something that Kamala Harris can rid herself of. We have seen former President Trump mention a lot this idea that it is Harris who bears equal responsibility as a vice presidential partner of President Biden. I also see Republicans today talking about the fact that they're casting Harris as putting forth a solution to what they consider a problem that she contributed to causing. Now, the merits of those arguments is a whole other debate, but that shows what the political counterpunch is in this year's campaign.
Chris, Niall said that quite correctly, that often it is the economy that decides the elections. At the moment, there seems to be a lot of confusion about where exactly the US economy is. Is it heading towards recession? Is it not heading towards the recession? What's your analysis of where it is at the moment?
You know, Rahul, I think that's a really excellent question. The economy actually has been motoring along at a 2 to 3% rate for the better part of a year. Which is quite healthy. That's after inflation, by the way. But in over and over again, particularly in the financial markets, I'm constantly hearing about recession fear. There's no indication of that in the data. I think the economy is quite a bit healthier than people think it is.
Niall, of course, the election in the U.S. is going to be decided, really, isn't it, in a few swing states. So that is who Kamala Harris, to some extent, is trying to address. When you were listening to her today, do you think she was able to get that economic message across in the way that she wanted to? Her attempts to distance herself from what many Americans have lived through, what they feel is very difficult, rising prices?
Yes, I actually think she was able to do that. And I thought it was an effective speech today, not purely on policy terms, but because she did try to make the kind of connection that you're talking about. She referred, for example, to the house that she grew up in, or the homes that she grew up in, being rented by her mother for much of her childhood and adolescence. Her mother, who was by then a single parent, having to save extraordinarily hard in order to afford a down payment for a home. Things like that that do connect her to more of an every woman or every man in the United States. Now, The caveat to all of that is the society and the media here is so sort of bifurcated that does that message get out to the people it needs to get out to, or does it get sort of lost in a Fox News right-wing conservative, oh, this woman's a communist going to, you know, impose central control of the economy? That's the question, I think.
It is the question. Now, thanks so much for joining us, Chris. 30 seconds for you here. What do you think the markets make of Kamala Harris? Former President Trump is seen as very pro-business. What will she have to do to gain more support within people from the financial sectors?
Well, you know, this is, I think, quite striking, too, because actually Biden-Harris policies have been extraordinarily pro-business. You just have to be in the right business. Green energy, for example, the chip makers have benefited from huge tax breaks under their various budget plans. So I don't think Trump necessarily is the business candidate. He's the traditional oil candidate. He's the traditional sort of finance candidate. But it depends what business you're in.
Yep, it certainly does. Chris, stay with us because we're going to move to Asia now. Thailand has a new prime minister. It is Prayuttan Chan-o-wat. She's the daughter of a former prime minister, and at 37, she's Thailand's youngest ever head of government. She says her government will have a strong and experienced team that aims to improve the lives of all Thais. But she faces the difficult task of reviving a stalled economy and managing relations with the military, which constrains the power of elected governments.
I talked to my family and I talked to a lot of people from my party, and I decided that it's about time to do something for the country and for the party as well. I hope that I can do my best to make the country go forward. Right now, of course, today is, I feel very honored.
The economy of Thailand has been one of Southeast Asia's strongest, but in recent years, the Philippines, Vietnam and Indonesia have been racing ahead. So how can the Thai economy improve? Pavida Panonont is a professor of international business at the Thammasat Business School.
We are suffering from the main source of income that came in tourism and foreign direct investment. But that is just one part of the bigger problem of Thailand not being competitive. And we are having a lot more competitors in the region. Investors are also asking more questions on their decision to go overseas and question of where they are when they decide on foreign direct investments. And that makes Thailand in risk falling behind if we just focus on the lowest hanging fruit of distribution of cash and populist policy.
Chris, that's one of the problems, isn't it? It's a very competitive part of the world, and other economies, particularly the likes of Vietnam and the Philippines, are moving ahead a lot quicker.
That's true. And I think, unfortunately, once you fall behind, it can take time. It's difficult to catch up. But I think they're focused on the right things here.
Yep, let us see. Tourism clearly a big part of the Thai economy that is, I know, slowly picking up because my son is there at the moment. So, no, he says it's pretty busy.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front. Every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Hello, I'm Simon Jack, the BBC's business editor.
And I'm Zing Sing, and I'm a journalist, author, and podcaster.
And it's great news. Good Bad Billionaire is back for a new season, now from the BBC World Service. So if you listened to our last series, welcome back. But if you're new to Good Bad Billionaire, why should people listen, Sing?
We are your new favourite podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the big money behind some of the world's richest people.
Some of these billionaire stories really are packed full of incident, intrigue, villainy in some cases.
Drama, family succession.
Yeah, if you like biopics, then this series is for you.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. In India, trains are set to begin to use the world's highest single-arch railway bridge. It's part of an important rail connectivity project that connects Indian-administered Kashmir with the rest of the country for the first time by rail. Nikhil Imandar has been taking a sneak peek and sent us this report on what it means for the economy of Kashmir.
The blowing of a train horn during a test run on India's new showpiece railway bridge. Ascending high over a deep ravine in the Riasi district of Jammu and Kashmir, this is the world's tallest single-arch rail bridge passing over the River Chenab. An inaugural train will start more than 20 years after construction first began.
So right here before me is this rather imposing Chenab Railway Bridge, rising up some 359 metres above the river below. Now just for comparison, that's 35 metres taller than Paris's Eiffel Tower. And it's surrounded by gorgeous mountains on all sides. I can only imagine that if you did take a train that passes over it, the views will be quite special.
These stunning Himalayan landscapes hide a bloody history. India and Pakistan have fought three wars in this heavily militarized state. It's also seen an armed insurgency since the 90s.
The bridge has been designed in such a manner that it can withstand contact blast.
The rail link will be crucial for the state during peacetime and in conflict, says Giridhar Rajgopalan, Deputy Managing Director of AFCON's infrastructure, which constructed the bridge for the Indian Railways.
It can permit the transport of military personnel and equipments around the year to the border areas, which would make a significant contribution to strengthening our border security arrangements.
It could also help the economy. An hour and a half drive from Kashmir's capital, Srinagar, we visited one of the state's largest cold storage facilities. The apple season was over, but before us, a profusion of plum harvest.
Kashmir is producing almost more than 80% of apples in the country.
7 in 10 Kashmiris depend on farming of such perishable fruit. Uber Shah, who owns the warehouse, told us road blockages and landslides during transport are a major concern for these farmers. The alternative to send produce by train, he said, could be a game changer.
Our only dependency right now is with the highway. So it's going to have huge impact in terms of that we'll have access to different markets, maybe the southern parts of India. That will have more demand for the produce and it will help increase the farmer income.
At Srinagar's famous Dal Lake, locals are seeing a fresh surge of tourists. Arrivals are up 30% in the first half of this year. Kashmir's breathtaking scenery has always been a draw, and the trains could bring in even more people. But a recent spurt in militant activity in the state is a reminder of the fragility of this peace. Without stability, better connectivity will go only so far in reviving the region's economy.
Nikhil Imandar reporting there. He was talking about trains. Let's stay on the transport theme because electric vehicles are the biggest source of demand for batteries, but that could be changing. Demand for stationary energy storage to help store daytime solar energy when the sun isn't shining, well, that's now beginning to catch up very quickly. How quickly? Well, I've been speaking to Colin McCratcher of Bloomberg NEF, who studies the global battery market.
Yeah, the one that's growing really rapidly is batteries for stationary storage applications. So those are things like a home backup battery, or for a large and commercial or industrial customer, a backup battery for their site. And also for utility scale batteries, where they're doing things like helping to integrate renewables onto the grid.
And when we're talking about those batteries, are we talking still about lithium batteries? Are we talking about vanadium batteries? Where are we seeing the most growth here?
Yeah, the vast majority of the batteries and energy storage capacity that's being installed right now is lithium-ion batteries. There's growing interest in some other areas, including sodium-ion batteries and a number of other technologies, but the vast majority of it today is lithium-ion.
And do you expect that to continue to grow in that particular area? And if that's growing very quickly, is there enough lithium for the EV market and also the stationary market that you're talking about as well?
Yes, certainly the next few years, lithium is going to be the dominant technology for stationary applications. There are some other contenders in the mix that could play an increasing role. Overall, what's happened in the last few years is that EVs are still the largest source of demand for lithium-ion batteries. Essentially, you have consumer electronics as now the smallest of the three groups, now stationary storage in the middle, and EVs are the largest. But stationary storage applications are growing so quickly, they've gone from about 6% of total battery demand in 2020 up to around 13% this year. So another way to think of that is the ratio of sort of EV battery demand to stationary battery demand. It was about 15 to 1 a few years ago. So for every 15 batteries going into an EV, there was one going into a stationary storage application. Now this year, it's going to be more like 6 to 1. So that's quite a change. And it shows that these stationary storage applications are now a material part of the global battery demand mix.
There are challenges, though, with lithium batteries, aren't there? And because the stationary ones are bigger, is it likely that at some stage we may look away from lithium because disposing of them is not easy, is it?
Actually, recycling lithium-ion batteries is very well established today. And you sometimes hear the stat of only 5% are recycled. That's actually not true at all. The vast majority of batteries today are recycled and that material can be recovered and used many times over. I think if there's something that displaces lithium, it will be because of cost. So sodium-ion, as I mentioned there, is a good contender for potentially very low costs, or because you want something that stores energy for a longer duration. So things like lithium ion batteries are best for kind of hours, maybe as long as a day. But beyond that, it gets difficult. Eventually, you will need to store or want to store energy for longer periods of time. Think of weeks or even months. That's where technologies other than lithium will play a role. And those could be things like compressed air storage or a number of other technologies that are vying to compete in that longer duration energy storage application mix.
Stationary storage is going to be very important, though, isn't it? Because particularly when we're looking to move towards more green energy, you know, wind power, solar, that's where you're going to need that stationary storage because you don't always have sunlight. You don't always have wind, do you?
Yeah, exactly. And that's really what we're seeing is more and more of those batteries that are being deployed are being used for that, what we call energy shifting applications. So yes, a certain amount is being generated during the day. Maybe not all of it is needed there, particularly for solar. You might have solar producing very low power prices during the day and even negative power prices. But then when the sun goes down, of course, you have to switch on gas peaking plants. And that is much more expensive. That leads to higher energy prices in those shoulder hours. What you're seeing now is that a lot of those batteries are being used to push essentially some of that sunlight into the evening, so further and further into the evening, and they're capturing a lot of value there. So a bigger and bigger share of the batteries that are being installed, these stationary batteries that are being installed, are being used for these bulk energy shifting applications to better integrate renewables onto the grid.
Chris Lowe's still with us. Fascinating to hear from Colin there. Chris, are we seeing a lot of American states investing heavily in these stationary big batteries?
We're starting to get in that direction. I think here we're a bit behind Europe and the UK, primarily because we put so much into natural gas generation, and also because we honestly need to put a lot more into our energy transport grid. But we're getting there, and certainly these new technologies are exciting and promising.
Well, let's end with a bit of sport now, because the new season of the English Premier League, if you don't know, that's football. We're going to say soccer for Chris, though. Got underway on Friday when Manchester United took on Fulham at Old Trafford, less than half a mile from where I'm sitting right now. They won 1-0, goal in the last minute or so. A capacity crowd of just under 80,000 were there. Before it kicked off, our reporter Luke Jarman spoke to some fans who were walking to the ground about their feelings and hopes for the new season.
Incredibly excited. It's had to be one of those summers where you don't sort of miss the Premier League too much because we've had so much sport over the summer, but there is nothing like the Premier League returning. I couldn't be more excited. I always get an incredible amount of hope before the first game, and I'm hoping it's not in vain. I've got a sneaky feeling it's going to be a a game that we're going to remember for a long time.
I'm pretty excited. I think new season, just ready to go. And after we won at Wembley, that was really good. So really excited that they can just make a fresh start tonight.
I'm Hugo, Manchester United fan.
And are you excited
yeah.
for tonight?
Yeah, I love.
And how are you feeling?
Happy and excited, hoping what the score is going to be like.
I'm a season ticket holder at United. But if I'm being honest with you, I don't have great expectations in terms of the type of position which a club like this should finish in. There's some positives there, but not sure why they haven't addressed certain matters before they start the season. Certainly need a goal scorer, someone to put the ball in the back of the net.
We're at Dockyard Pub, just having a few before the game. Hopefully picking up 3 points tonight in Ten Hag we trust.
Yeah, I suppose you can't get away that money runs everything and it's slowly integrated itself into football. It's obviously a massive factor, but at the end of the day, when you're there to watch a football game with the people, like I say, the people around you, the money's not an issue. All that I suppose I ask for is respect the fans, respect the people that are coming, keep the prices fair, keep the prices reasonable.
That's what a lot of football fans want, isn't it? The Premier League is one of the world's big businesses and it has fans in every particular part of the world, particularly Manchester United. It is the most watched sports league in the world. Let's give you some figures. Broadcast in 212 territories to 643 million homes with a potential audience of 4.7 billion people. Well, somebody who was watching today's game was Claudia Susano, a Manchester United fan based in Lima, the capital of Peru. Claudia, thanks for joining us. Give us a sense of how popular the Premier League is, where you are, how popular Manchester United are.
Okay, hello everybody. Well, since we watched the Football World Cup, you know, and see how the English players perform, there is an interest in knowing which teams they belong to. That's why the Premier League is popular here in Peru. There are other fans clubs like us, Manchester United fan clubs official in Peru, like, for example, Arsenal, Chelsea or Liverpool. And it's very popular here in Peru, the English football.
OK, tell me, you support Manchester United. Do you have a local club in Peru that you support as well? And which one are you more attached to? Which one are you more fanatical about?
Yes, here in Peru, we follow Sporting Cristal and Universitario de Deportes. That's the most popular local teams here in Peru. But, I've been following Manchester United for almost 12 years. And I like football and also my husband too. So I became a fan of Manchester United. No? That's why I prefer... Yes, Manchester United over the local teams, no?
Okay, well, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. You can choose whoever you want to support. Tell me, how many members do you have within your Manchester United club? And is it getting more and more popular?
Yes, now official members are 60. It's a very huge number because we play, for example, we make football tournaments here with another fans clubs and also that increase our members, no?
Claudia, you've had a good start to the season. You won 1-0. Keep watching and I hope it's a good season for you. Well, I don't really because I support Leeds United. If you don't know, we're big rivals of Manchester United. But listen, thank you very much for joining us. Chris, a lot of sport, 30 seconds on this, I'm afraid, you know, gets money from TV deals. And it's interesting, there's been a... Well, Chris has left us actually. So no Chris Lowe at all. Interesting there to hear from Claudia there. I was in India recently and there in Kolkata, which is the home of football, as I walked around the streets, I saw more people wearing Manchester United tops than I actually saw wearing Indian cricket tops. Absolutely fanatical support for the likes of Manchester United, Liverpool, Chelsea as well there. I have to say, my football club, the beloved Leeds United, whilst I was walking the streets of India, I wasn't able to spot anybody wearing their football shirts. At all, that is it for this edition of World Business Report.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app that makes using different currencies easy. With Wise, you can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate. There are no hidden fees either. See exactly what you'll pay up front, every time. Join 16 million customers already saving with Wise. To learn how Wise could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com.
Hello, I'm Simon Jack, the BBC's business editor.
And I'm Xing Xing, and I'm a journalist, author and podcaster.
And it's great news. Good Bad Billionaire is back for a new season, now from the BBC World Service. So if you listened to our last series, welcome back. But if you're new to Good Bad Billionaire, why should people listen, Xing?
We are your new favourite podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the big money behind some of the world's richest people.
Some of these billionaire stories really are packed full of incident, intrigue, villainy in some cases.
Drama, family succession.
Yeah, if you like biopics, then this series is for you.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.